I will not go through a long history of what Stalin did, his accomplishments and his demerits. Most of those things you can find in ordinary bourgeois books. I want to go over the things that you're not going to hear from anybody except a Stalin supporter like myself. Stalin was the leader of the Soviet Union from 1924 to 1953. Lenin died. He was the leader of the Russian Revolution. And he led the Russian Revolution in 1917 out of World War I. And he died in 1924, and Stalin became the leader of the party at that point. So he pretty much was leader of the Soviet Union from 1924 to 1953. And that's 29 years of time. That's a lot of things to talk about. I don't think the mic is dead. I don't think it's going.
Oh.
Or did you just turn it down?
If that helps, you can turn it on. It wasn't
supposed to be on. Okay, all right. So in 29 years, a lot of things happened, and I don't think in the hour that we're here, we're going to be able to go over all of them. So I'm here more to present you some of the provocative things that you need to look for when you study this question yourself or when you come across it. In 1 minute, I can tell you what Stalin's accomplishments were. He led the fastest industrialization in the world seen up to that point. He applied Lenin's thought to do this. He moved so fast that this was a factor in why Hitler attacked the Soviet Union. When he gave his last testament in 1945, Hitler said that he always had a nightmare, night after night, before 1941, that Stalin would move first, that Stalin would be improving and improving the situation in the Soviet Union, and that he would actually attack Germany before Hitler got around to attacking him. And this is because the degree to which Hitler respected Stalin for what he was doing at the time, knowing that this was a worthwhile adversary. And I'm going to pass around the statistics on that. You often don't hear about the comparative statistics on the industrialization in the Soviet Union. But, for instance, in the 1930s, the United States was in a depression. In fact, all the Western capitalist industrial countries were in a depression. And the economies were stagnating. So if you were a business person at that time, you can read this in business papers, the equivalent of the Wall Street Journal of that time. Even there, you would see that admissions that the Soviet Union was growing economically and was going to leave capitalism in the dust. So if you lived in the 1930s, that's what you thought. You thought that things look like capitalism is going to be ground into the dust. It's in the midst of a huge crisis, double-digit unemployment, and Stalin's Soviet Union is growing and growing. And I'm going to pass around some figures on that, comparative figures, that show the situation with the Soviet Union compared with that of the United States, Britain, Germany, and France, which are the other major industrial powers at the time. This graph here just kind of shows you the black bar is the Soviet industrial growth. Going up and up, and in the same years, you can kind of see a stagnation of the major industrial capitalist countries. We're going to come back to that because establishing a developed industrial society that quickly was what got a lot of attention in the Third World, especially after World War II. When the Soviet Union became the number one or two superpower in the world. It was a very clear situation after World War II, after 1945, that the Soviet Union emerged under Stalin as one of the top two military powers in the world. Now that doesn't have any meaning to you unless you understand, of course, the history behind that as well. This is another, why we call this an accomplishment. Russia was not always the number two or number one military power in the world. In fact, just in 1905, Japan beat it very soundly in a war on Russia's east coast. And in 1917, Russia was so pathetic, it was pretty much soldiers going into battle with pitchforks. They were being destroyed on the front with Germany. And if you, I'll show you a picture of this later, but if you know the map of Europe, there's Germany in the middle, France on the left side, or the west side, and Russia way over here. And so the Germans were pretty much cakewalking to this direction, and they won their battle with the Russians took up tons of territory, and even under Lenin, they had to surrender all the Ukraine to the Germans when they asked for it. And you may have heard in World War I that the real battle was in the trenches between Germany and France. Millions of people lost their lives in this really slow and methodical war in which people were dug down in trenches and they shot each other. That was the tough battle at the time, France and Germany going at each other with England backing up France. So Russia was nothing. The top military powers were Germany, England, France, United States. That's what it was when the Russian Revolution came about. But a mere 20 years later, mostly under Stalin's leadership, the situation was different and the Soviet Union became a military power, and that's largely because of the industrial situation. Let me just read one quote from a book that came out just in 1998. It's called Stalingrad. It's about the most important battle of World War II. The importance of the industrialization under Stalin to the outcome of World War II. By the way, this book is by Anthony Bivore. During the summer, this was after Germany attacked in 1941, when Germany was producing approximately 500 tanks a month, General Halder had told Hitler that the Soviet Union was producing 1,200 a month. The Führer had slammed the table and said it simply was not possible. Now, the Führer, this is Hitler, the Nazi leader of Germany, was furious to hear that, wow, Stalin was outproducing me in tanks. And in fact, Bivore continues, he says, even this figure was far too low. In 1942, Soviet tank production was rising from 11,000 during the first 6 months to 13,600 during the second half of the year, an average of over 2,200 a month. So actually, at that point, under Stalin, from a situation of vast military inferiority, the Soviet Union went to producing more than four times as many tanks as Germany per month. And these were not low-quality tanks. The Germans had a hard time piercing the armor of these tanks. And in fact, they were superior to the German tanks in quality as well, at least in many important regards. So, and usually you can read any bourgeois history book and they'll tell you the industrial statistics of the time, the growth under Stalin, steel tons, the aluminum, the glass. And you can get lost in those kind of historical facts. So that's why I'm going to try to keep this brief. There's two more things I want to mention in his accomplishments to sum them up historically. This is covering, again, 30 years of time. He was the first to lead the collectivization of agriculture. This happened as the United States was having its own Dust Bowl depression, and the so-called NEP in the Soviet Union was running out of steam. Agricultural production was decreasing instead of making more grain available to the cities and feeding more people. And Stalin came in and, no doubt with brutal force, collectivized agriculture. And that meant that people who had previously sold things on the free market, sold their grain, their foodstuffs, now were in collective farms trying to put their livestock together and having their produce taken to the cities, more or less by force, but with the help, cooperation of the lower and middle peasants, who, contrary to what you hear a lot these days, a lot of them really did hate the rich peasants, the landlords, not to mention the landlords who had been expropriated under Lenin, but who hated the so-called kulaks. So that's the first time that had happened in history, and it laid the basis for the industrialization that I had just already discussed. Fourth thing I want to mention about Stalin's accomplishments was the staunch political leadership that he provided through that whole period of time that essentially saw, 5 years after his coming to power, the global depression and the onset of World War II. Now, the West, the United States in particular, likes to tell you that World War II started in 1939 when Germany invaded Poland. But we communists don't quite see it that way because Italy invaded Abyssinia, Ethiopia. Before that, Japan was attacking the Soviet Union and landing in Manchuria in China. So there were a lot of invasions by the so-called Axis powers, that those were Germany, Italy, and Japan at that time, that were already in motion. Not to mention that even in Europe, of course, Czechoslovakia was taken in 38, just taken apart by the Germans. So we don't agree with that conception, but point being that from 1924 to 1953, Stalin saw the Great Depression, World War II, and then just before, as he was dying, the Korean War. And he provided the staunch political leadership through this whole time that prepared the Soviet Union to win against Hitler, protect itself, and emerge as a respected superpower. Some of the things he did that were notable in this regard, I'll just mention Spain, sending weapons to Spain in the 1930s, especially the Civil War hit its peak around 36. The only country in the world that was willing to do that, that's the only government in the whole world that sent weapons to the anti-fascist, anti-Nazi side in Spain. And you hear a lot of things now today about Stalin did this and that to mess up the resistance movement in Spain, but this is essentially an argument amongst friends in Spain. There was no other country, not the United States, not France, not England, none of these people that claim to have been such great anti-fascists, none of them sent any actual military aid to the Spanish when they were fighting against fascists armed and trained by the Germans. And if you, you know, to locate this in history for you, you may have heard Picasso, and this famous painting, I think it's called the Guernica, is about the first bombing, modern bombing of history. It's about Spain. It's because the Germans had arranged for bombings of the so-called Republicans in Spain, the anti-Nazi side. And that horror occurred and went on without any response from the supposedly great anti-fascists of the United States, France, England, and so on. So that's the kind of staunch person that Stalin was, is that while these others were more powerful, but too afraid to fight Hitler, Stalin, you know, put the Russian government out on a limb and fought by proxy in Spain. Another thing that he did, and this gets to why he's so infamous as well as famous, infamous in bourgeois eyes, was his treatment of the internal enemies in the Soviet Union. He called them class enemies. And it was at this time, and the whole time while these attacks on the internal enemies in the Soviet Union were occurring, this took a very staunch hand. It was done with the explanation and justification that the Soviet Union is already engaged in a war, class war internally, but also a war with external enemies. Hitler made it very clear when he wrote his Mein Kampf book that he was coming for Russia. This was already, you know, by the time Stalin was coming to power. Most people believed, Stalin included, that it was a matter of time before World War I resumed and the Germans came again. It was only a question of when. When are the Germans going to come again? This is the history. World War I is over, but the Russians still expect the Germans to come again. And they're right. And there's a famous quote from 1929 in which Stalin predicted that we have 10 years to industrialize or be crushed. He goes through, he laid it out for his peoples. We have 10 years to get ready. And if we don't do it, we will be crushed. So let me... just one more point about his accomplishments. I'm going to return to this Beevor book. Most of you have heard about these arduous things, you know, the purges, executions, which could have been anywhere from hundreds of thousands into the millions of internal enemies in the Soviet Union, people that we call over here probably dissidents, probably a lot of people who aren't even necessarily that outspoken, but who somehow got in the way, to describe it literally in the words of some of the Soviet people, got in the way of preparing for the war. And we're not at all denying that this happened, that there were executions and people who seemed to be screwing up the war effort were essentially gotten out of the way, they were executed. Now, I'm going to tell you a quote from something, this is coming out now. This is something you won't necessarily read in some of your dusty old books because this is, you know, again, material that keeps coming out as time goes on and World War II passes. Something you may not have heard is that in the Battle of Stalingrad, the turning point of all of World War II, 50,000 Russians were armed and fighting on the German side. And this is 6th Army, this is a quote from Bjor, 6th Army had over, this is Nazi Army, had over 50,000 Russian auxiliaries attached to its frontline divisions, representing over a quarter of their strength. To give you a description of some of the things that were done, this is something getting into the national question as well. The German officers were so happy with the way that the traitors were performing that they lauded them with extreme praise. And Bivor, he openly wonders, you know, during the whole Battle of Stalingrad, why the Germans didn't give up. But I think it's even more amazing the Russians didn't give up. The Russians who were fighting on the Nazi side, and it's not just Russians, I simplify when I say Russians, I should say Soviet peoples. Why did they continue to fight? Well, after a certain point, yes, they had to fight because they didn't fight and they lost, they knew they were going to be executed. I mean, when you're a traitor and you lose the war, it's pretty obvious that afterwards you're going to be executed for crime. So they expected, that's one reason they fought. But listen to some what the Nazis had to say about some of these traitors. Quote, especially brave were the Tartars, reported an officer in the factory district of Stalingrad. Quote, as anti-tank gunners using a captured Russian weapon, they were proud of every Soviet tank they hit. These fellows were fantastic, unquote. Lieutenant Colonel Mader's group, based on two grenadier regiments from the 297th Infantry Division at the southernmost point of the Kessel, contained no fewer than 780, quote, combat-willing Russians, unquote, nearly half his force. That's something you don't hear a lot about, that, yeah, Stalin was known for executing a lot of people, but still, when it came down to it, there were 50,000 Soviet peoples fighting in the Battle of Stalingrad on the wrong side. And as the Stalinists would say after that, in other words, there were 50,000 people who should have been executed before the war got that far, who weren't. And that's a brutal truth. That's a harsh reality to accept. Now, why do we say that? Well, it's a life or death situation. It's something that we, in our comfort right now in 1999, don't often face. We start to see a little of it in the Balkans, what goes on with ethnic cleansing and the brutality of that kind of war. But the Russians, let's not forget, a good estimate of the number of people they lost in the war was 27 million people. 27 million. When you talk about the Jewish Holocaust, we're talking about 6 million people. That's like one of the most horrific events in history. We're talking about 27 million Russians in the same period of time. So we know, wow, this is something that we in 1999 probably can't even relate to on any level. Just can't relate to it. So I'm here telling you some very harsh things. Yes, Stalin executed at least hundreds of thousands of people in his reign. That's the low-end estimates, and some people will tell you millions, and I'll get into that later. But we have to look at the context that this was done in. The Soviet Union was always between a rock and a hard place. 1924, only a couple years had passed before the imperialist armies had withdrawn from the Soviet Union. What do I mean, imperialist armies? I mean English troops on Soviet soil. I mean French military invasion. You know, this was going on in the Civil War of the USSR, and the Russians remember this, and they're right. The Germans are coming. They're coming again. So this is something to consider about the times. I don't want you to just... When you look at the Stalin history, and like I say, I only have an hour, we're not going to get into all of it. This is the question I want you to have in your mind. In that context, was there a better solution to defend yourself as a person, as a nation? Was there a better solution than Stalin? It's easy. I can tell you I'm a Stalinist, and I will tell you those were horrible times. No Stalinist is going to deny that to this current day. Those were horrible times. Question is, when you are in horrible times, what is the best of all possible solutions to your predicament? And in this, we find that Stalin still stands out. Now, the Battle of Stalingrad, by the way, 500,000, just in that battle alone, 500,000 Russians died. Okay, that's the largest battle, single battle in history. And I want to pass around a map because I know that a lot of this World War II history is being lost completely in people's minds, but it's still kind of seeping out. We're still people who were keeping quiet during the war and the aftermath because of the Cold War are now starting to write books, and we're starting to see some things that are continue to vindicate Stalin. I'm going to pass around this map in case you don't know how far Hitler and the Nazis got into the Soviet Union. This map here shows, you know, like I was saying before, Germany is kind of in the center of Europe, and they marched through Poland and Czechoslovakia through the so-called Balkan countries that we hear about today, and penetrated into the Soviet Union. And you're going to see from this map how far he got, because I'm going to tell you, he got all the way over here to the east, to Stalingrad. That's the big battle where it finally turned around. Hitler marched all the way through Europe, all the way through Eastern Europe, all the way up to Stalingrad. All right? And so this is the map. Take a look at that. If you're not aware of how far Hitler got, this is something you need to know. You need to understand. You need to understand the times Hitler was, he was popular. He had support of government figures, not just in Germany, not just in Austria, which joined up with Germany. But you may have heard of this term Quisling. Well, this comes from traitors, we call them now, but they were actually government officials in the case of Norway, also in Finland, who became Nazis. They overthrew their existing governments because they liked this Nazi idea and they wanted to join up. So when 3 million troops invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, let me read you who it was. It wasn't just Germans. Okay, there were 79 German divisions. This is a quote from Bruce Flanken, by the way. He's an English professor. He's one of those professors, by the way, who in the great United States has been fired from his job for political reasons. I won't get into that. But he explains it here. There were 79 German divisions, okay, that we expect, marching into the Soviet Union. But there were 22 Romanian divisions. There was a civil war in Romania in which the Nazis won, the Nazi pro-fascist side won. 14 Finnish divisions, 13 Hungarian divisions, 10 Italian, we knew about the Italians, 10 Italian divisions, 1 Slovak division, 1 Spanish division, we knew about that there was a split in Spain. A total of well over 3 million troops, the best armed and most experienced in the world, attacked along a 2,000-mile front. So I'm telling you, Hitler, fascism, Nazism, these ideas were, we have to understand, they were popular at the time. They were exterminated by history. But don't think it was easy. That's the thing. They were widely popular at the time. They were so popular that in France, remember now, France was the tough guy in Europe in World War I, you know, where they had the trench warfare and they duked it out for a few square yards of turf and millions would die over it, just, you know, the mud, basically. If you move the lines forward a few yards, moving back would cost you tens of thousands of lives. France was tough. In World War II, France collapsed in 6 weeks. Why? Because the French people were in confusion. They had poor leadership. They were part of a capitalist country that had no resistance to fascism as an ideology. They had no organized resistance. They didn't have purges. They didn't crush their dissidents that were pro. In fact, now it's coming out in 1994. There was a book published finally that Mitterrand, the president of France, up until 1994, I'm talking about somebody you were alive to be contemporary of, the president of France, turns out, and this is published in the Boston Globe now as well, you can check it out, the references are on our website, he was a bootlicking officer. He was not only a member of a fascist party when he was 19, okay, 19-year-olds make mistakes, but he continued, he was an assistant to the leader of the so-called Vichy government of France, which was the Nazis' puppet government in France. And not only did he serve as an assistant and win awards as such during World War II, but he continued, after World War II was over and the Germans had lost, he continued to lay flowers on the grave of the leaders of the Vichy government. And this is all documented. This is in a large book. So some of these people, and there's also the same situation in Italy.